Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers episode number 59, The Hubble Crisis. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/59. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as related episodes of Physics Frontiers. And now, Jim and Randy. So, hey, Randy, what's going on?
Jim, we're going to talk about one of the most interesting, I think, features of modern cosmology today. We're going to talk about the Hubble parameter crisis. And the reason we're going to do that is because in recent years, the measurements of the Hubble parameter, they used to call it the Hubble constant, if you'll recall from your days in high school or college. Now they're calling it the Hubble parameter because they know it's probably not constant. And this seems to be, you know, like particle physics used to be the really exciting frontier where we could expect to see, you know, new discoveries and perhaps an expansion of our understanding of physics and all of that. But that seems to have kind of faded because the LHC didn't really find anything it wasn't looking that it didn't expect to find. And like I think Sabine Hossenfelder also agrees that that's kind of been tapped out as our path forward. But the modern cosmological observations are raising all kinds of interesting questions and conundrums. And I mean, at first there was the discovery of dark matter, and then there was the discovery of dark energy. And now with things like the dark energy survey and the cosmic microwave background analyses and everything, we can start to really get precision numbers on cosmological factors like the Hubble parameter. And so in recent years, there's been an increasing significance to the disparity that different experiments are finding to try to measure the Hubble parameter. And the Hubble parameter is the rate at which the universe is expanding at the large, like extra galactic scale, like the distances between the galaxy clusters is increasing. It's increasing at a more or less constant rate over sort of statistically large volumes. But now that they've got several different technologies to try to estimate it, they're coming up with different answers. And some of these studies are coming up with very high precision answers that are coming into increasing tension. I think they're saying now that the current tension between different very reliable estimates for the Hubble parameter is reached a 4.4 sigma significance. And, you know, that's, as most people know, a 5 sigma level of significance is kind of this gold standard for reporting a scientific discovery in the area of particle physics. And so now, you know, astrophysics is getting to the point where it's getting the same kind of precision that we were seeing with particle physics, and we're seeing some real mysteries that are hard to resolve. So we're going to talk about the different types of estimates that are being done and what they seem to point to, and maybe some of the ideas that, you know, could theoretically explain what's going on. I should probably just mention briefly, we're seeing now for the first time like gravitational wave measurements playing a part. It's like an entirely new type of technology in physics that's going to help us understand the Hubble parameter. And they've got a whole new channel now. Like up until just recently, we had to rely completely on electromagnetic measurements from astronomers in order to gauge things like the intergalactic recession using the supernova 1A data and that kind of thing. And now we've got an entirely new channel. And where we used to hear about standard candles, you know, the supernova data being a standard candle so you could tell how far away something was based on how bright it was with those supernova explosions. Now they're talking about a standard siren because of the signal of gravitational waves is kind of like an acoustic signal. So I find that's really fascinating stuff. I hadn't realized that they were able to use gravitational waves in order to estimate the Hubble parameter. But here we go. You know, it's here now. It's rapidly evolving science.
Yeah, I think they did that once. I think that's one of the papers we've got here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did you read that one?
Yeah, I didn't have time to read all of them in great detail because we're looking at over 90 pages of papers here.
Now, you have to actually look at the papers. Like, if you look at the gravitational waves one, yeah, gravitational wave measurement of the Hubble constant following the second observing run of Advanced LIGO and Virgo. Mm-hmm. And I will not read the authors because the authors
it's an army.
Takes four pages.
Yeah, okay? I know. The authors and their institutions takes like 5 or 6 pages.
It's six pages. You get two lines after the abstract on the sixth page, and then you have another couple of pages of references. So it looks like you're going to read a 21-page paper.
And you
really only have like 14. And another one of these has another long list as well. I don't know which ones you read in there, but because we switched one out.
Oh, I didn't realize we switched them out, so I kind of scanned over all of them.
Okay. Yeah, I read them all, so I just expected you'd get rid of one of those two 20-page papers and be done with it. So, yeah, we've got this Hubble constant, and basically that is the slope of the line, right? The velocity of an object relative to us, its recession from us versus its distance. And like you said, we find that electromagnetically. And what we do is, you know, for different kinds of stars and stuff, we can put out spectra. So if you have like a supernova, supernova 1A, you know what its lines are. And you also know how bright that's supposed to be, so you can figure out what its distance is. You have something called a distance ladder, and what that sort of means is that, you know, for close things, we can look at parallax, and then for things way out there, we have to use these standard candles, and there are a couple of other ways we can measure things as well. I think we've recently, I forgot the name of the probe, we've recently gotten some European data that improves how far we can do parallax as well. They say that's actually increased the accuracy of the distance scales and the distance ladder. And, of course, when you increase the accuracy of those scales, it's going to do something to your estimate of the Hubble constant, because that's the slope of that line. Mm-hmm. And that's just made the Hubble constant go up a little bit. And I should say that when we look at things this way, with velocity versus distance, mm-hmm. this Hubble constant, which sort of says how fast everything's expanding, for these sorts of measurements, it ends up being about 73, 74 kilometers per second per megaparsec.
Let me just clarify for a quick second. If people are wondering what a megaparsec is, it's about 3.26 million light years. The radius of the Milky Way is like 100,000 light years. So it's like 30 times greater than that.
So we look at the extinction from that distance ladder to get that distance by how much that intensity is reduced. And then the velocities we get from the shift, the red shift of the spectrum of the supernova or something else. But the super, you know, you usually they'll use these standard candles to try to figure out when you're looking at something in the sky where it is, right? You say, okay, we've seen a supernova over that way, so we kind of know how far away that's supposed to be. So they use the supernova because they all have the same spectrum, because they all have the same physics, which is nice. So you get those velocities from the redshift because of special relativity. If something's moving away from you, you get shift towards the red part of the spectrum, so longer wavelengths of light. And the common example is the Doppler shift for sound, right, where you're sitting by a train, it comes by with its horn on, and you hear a high then a low-pitched squeal from it.
Right, as it approaches and then passes you, yeah.
So that's the old way to do it, right? And that was a very bad way to do it. Actually, it's very good now, but the problems that they had, if you look at the older data, it's all over the place, right? If you look at data from before, let's say, off the top of my head, 2005, you have these errors that are like plus or minus 5.
And I remember back then seeing Hubble constant estimates at like 62 kilometers per second per megaparsec. You know, like it was much lower.
If you look at that data, there's a lot of it, and it's just all over the place. And then after the Planck observation of the cosmic microwave background radiation, they had an independent way of looking at this, and that was actually very good in comparison. You know, you can look at the redshifts in that data, and you can sort of extrapolate from what you think the initial Hubble parameter was to what it should be today.
And by initial Hubble parameter, you mean right after the surface of last scattering, when all the matter in the universe generated the CMB that we see now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they extrapolate that forward to now, and then you get the 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec.
They also call the surface of last scattering a recombination, right? Because that's when the universe cooled down enough that electrons and protons assembled to form atoms, and then that released a very specific light wave signature, and then we use that to estimate the redshift.
Yeah, I mean, there is a parameter in one of these books. They're not that big. They're not that long. I'm sorry. In one of these papers that they use to figure this out, and that's a ratio of the co-moving sound horizon at decoupling. That's basically the early physics.
Yeah, I think that era was like 300-some thousand years after the Big Bang.
So they're looking at this ratio of that sound horizon to the diameter, basically, of the surface of last scattering, which has to do with the current physics. So what's happening now? Basically, the H0 that we're looking at, the Hubble constant, is dependent on a parameter like that. That's when all of this got better. But then it would get worse because they improved these original measurements, and those ended up being at about 73 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And they keep doing things to make them better and hoping the numbers will come together. And it looks like everything that you do pushes them apart. Basically, that's what I'm seeing. I don't know if that's what you saw in this.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing too. And different technologies are kind of helping to hone those parameters, because the more of these different types of measurements that you use to kind of correlate your understanding of the distance and velocities, the more precise your numbers get, and their margins of error get much smaller. And now these margins of error are getting so small that it looks like they might not be reconcilable.
It's definitely looking that way. Although, if you look at some of these other things that we're going to look at, there are other estimates that are ending up right in the middle. And one of them is one we already talked about, which was the gravitational wave situation. The gravitational waves are ending up at about 6970 kilometers per second per megaparsec, which is, you know, right there in the middle, but there's plus or minus 8 error or something like that. So that doesn't help very much.
Right. Yeah, I should have made a list to see what each one of the estimates were with their errors, because as I recall, we seem to have a spectrum anywhere between like 64 or 65 kilometers per megaparsec all the way up to like almost 74, around 74 kilometers per megaparsec, right?
Okay, so what I've got here is for the baryon acoustic oscillations enhancing the cosmic microwave background from Planck, you get about 65.
Okay.
When I made up the list, I just shaved off the point whatever.
Okay, good.
The strong lensing, which we also looked at, which is sort of a gravitational way to do it, looked at about 73. Distance ladder, I wrote down here about 73. LIGO was about 69. The WMAP was about 69. That was an older version of what they're doing with the Planck. So if you plot these out for the same kind of measurement, it's sort of moved towards that 67 or 60. I have 65 here, but that 67 we were talking about from the Planck previously. I think it's a two season. I don't know what that was. That had a 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec. There was something called the SBTS2, which was 71 kilometers per second per megaparsec, but I'm not sure what that was. And then there are a whole bunch of different analyses from Planck going from 64 to 70, but I think 67 is sort of the latest, bestest one before they started looking at those baryon acoustic oscillations as a model in the early universe that changes things and actually reduces, like I was saying before, it reduces the cosmic microwave background number so that two numbers are getting farther apart, just like the distance ladder improvement pushes those other numbers up to like 74 or 75. So now we have these two things. It's 4.4 sigma. It's not really just one for either of these two different branches. We have another measurement, like you said, with gravitational waves. That's got so much error that it doesn't really help us. But basically, we're looking at things that look like sort of gravitational or local measurements giving you 75, and these global measurements giving you 65.
So that's what I wanted to ask, is when we look at the Hubble parameter estimates based on distances that are like huge, almost to like the cosmic horizon, and then we scale back and look at all of the estimates in between as we approach our local area, is there a clear trend that the universe is basically accelerating in the same way that we see with dark energy and everything?
I did not see anything that was looking at the different places. So some of these are very local measurements, right?
Okay.
I didn't see anything that was plotting their distance versus what we see.
Because, I mean, it seems intuitive, doesn't it, to think that there might be a time evolution to the Hubble parameter?
Yes, yes. And I spent a lot of time playing around with that over the past couple of weeks, then realized yesterday that everything that I was doing was wrong.
I applaud you for the effort, because that was the burning question that I had after reading through these.
You know, they have equations in there that basically say that the Hubble constant is going to change with time. And if I can find the right one, I can look at it. Well, I don't know how to read the equation, though. See, there's a problem. Is the equation has a parameter that's not really the time. It's sort of a normalized time in some way, but they don't tell me exactly how it was normalized. I know that zero means now. But I don't know. I don't even know if negative is in the past or positive is in the past. So I can't really interpret the equation.
Oh, yeah.
But it looks like it would get larger with time, in my view. But the definitions that I have seen, I'm not completely sure what's happening with that particular parameter.
These papers are basically challenging and looking at the standard cosmological model. So I think what they've got in that scenario is that we have they expect a certain kind of Hubble parameter, right? So what they're looking at in these papers is they're looking at the standard cosmological model, which is the lambda cold dark matter model. And I think in that model, you've got both dark energy and dark matter. And within that model, there's a Hubble parameter. And that's kind of a general rate of expansion of the whole universe.
Well, I think lambda, we should mention, is the cosmological constant. So it's not just there's dark energy. It's a particular kind of dark energy.
Right, but they're separated out. They're looking at a certain value for the cosmological constant, and then the Hubble parameter is a different value. So we're not, like, they're not conflating dark energy with the Hubble parameter, right?
No, they're not the same thing. The dark energy is a different thing. They're deriving the Hubble constant that you'd expect from that model, basically.
Well, this is a key question that has been beguiling me for a while. Why is there a Hubble parameter in the first place? The Big Bang model, when all of the matter and all the galaxies eventually formed and got thrown apart, that this isn't a momentum thing, right? That it was a space-time expansion thing that drove the expansion of the universe. So why are they still – why are they moving apart so fast? I guess doesn't there have to be some kind of field making the Hubble parameter?
The Hubble parameter would exist even if the universe is slowing down. All the Hubble parameter means is that the farther out you look, the faster things are going.
Right. And if it was slowing down, then it would be a negative value, right?
Possibly, if you take it, but you also have to take into account. You also have to take into account the constancy of the speed of light, right? So, as you look farther out, you're looking earlier in the universe. So it should be going faster farther out, no matter what. So it's just how much faster it's going farther out. That's the thing. So I guess if the universe is expanding, is accelerating, then that Hubble constant goes down because the distance things it was expanding less. Yeah, there had been less acceleration, so the velocity should be lower.
Okay, so what is the driving factor of what creates the Hubble parameter in the first place?
In the universe modeled by a cosmological constant, the cosmological constant, that negative energy, that's going to be a big part of that Hubble parameter. It's not going to be everything.
Oh, okay. It's a contributing factor. All right.
So gravity's also still there, right? You know, the matter is still there. The matter's slowing everything down. The dark energy is pushing it out. And so there's a tension there. And that's going to balance out and give you that Hubble constant.
So when they're talking about, in one of these papers, I lost track of which one, they're saying that their observations were consistent with general relativity, and they were looking at like cosmological scales. So they're saying that it's consistent with general relativity when we include the cosmological constant.
That's right.
All right.
So most of these papers, except two, basically just assume lambda cold dark matter. The two that don't are the one that has to do with the strong lensing, and the other one is the rock and roll solutions to the Hubble tension. Now, the rock and roll solutions, that's a theoretical paper. It's mm-hmm. trying to figure out some reason why the world isn't doing what they think it was doing. So they've got a reason why there could be a difference, mm-hmm. and that's sort of injecting energy into the universe at a very specific time for a very specific duration. And the strong lensing is just one of these measurements. So they've done this measurement in the past, and what they decided to do was to try to test modified gravities at the same time that they're measuring that parameter. So what they're doing is they're using both the Hubble parameter, H0, and a ratio that basically parameterizes the kind of non-Newtonian gravity you have in the parameterized post-Newtonian framework that we talked about previously. It just basically modifies the metric for space time, modifies the line element a little bit, modifies the ruler that you use so that the ruler between space and time is a little bit off. They actually got a number for that parameterized post-Newtonian parameter, which, if it's different from one, is different from general relativity. They said that was about 0.87.
Plus or minus.
Plus or minus about 0.18. So that includes one.
That's right.
Right. And then it got, 73 kilometers per second per megaparsec for Hubble. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not completely sure how sensitive H0 is to a change in gamma BPN. Let's put it that way. Yeah, they were just looking at lensing around different stars and things like that as light comes to the Earth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we've got one situation where they're looking at modifying gravity as well. They're looking at what if you have something other than just this flat cosmological constant.
Yeah, a new scalar field. It would come into play at a very specific instant.
No, that's the Rock and Roll Solutions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Rock and Roll Solutions is a theory paper that says, okay, we're going to have basically this injection of energy into the universe is what it is. That new scalar field comes in and goes away for a limited duration. So basically, there's a Big Bang, the universe is evolving, and then at some point, for no particular reason that we know of, right, there would be a reason, but not that we know of, into the universe comes a whole bunch of energy, speeds up its acceleration for a little while.
But on the other hand, we've already got that problem with the inflationary model. They don't really understand what drove that incredibly fast inflationary epoch. I think they theorized a new particle, a new field. They call it a dilaton field. Or no, it's an inflaton field. So it would be a particle we've never seen. So I don't think we even understand what caused the initial, inflationary, that really, really rapid period of expansion that only lasted for an incredibly small fraction of a second.
No, you don't. But this would be like an additional thing that just sort of happened. And its only reason to exist is to explain this difference in the parameter in different measurements. So it's not really strong. Well, I shouldn't say that because this guy's from Harvard. This guy's from Brown. I guess if they do it, it's really strong. Who am I to say that it's not that strong?
I noticed the name of Lisa Randall on that paper in the Rock and Roll Solutions to the Hubble Tension. She's a Harvard physicist, a theoretical physicist. I've heard her interviewed. First time I heard about her was on an interview on the old Art Bell show. And she's really, really smart.
Yeah, she was on that paper there. So she's really, really smart. And they've got lots of plots.
And really, when you think about it, the inflationary model itself was driven kind of by the same kind of considerations. Like, they couldn't understand the whole, the whole evolution of the universe and how it could be so uniformly homogeneous unless it had suddenly expanded, incredibly, dozens of orders of magnitude faster than the speed of light for an incredibly brief period. So we had to infer there must be an inflationary period. And this isn't really that different.
Well, I mean, we infer these things, right? But what does it really mean? I'm not that amazed with the inflaton, for example.
Yeah, me either. It seems like it's like a missing piece of the puzzle, really.
Yeah. So other people love it, but it's not really my cup of tea. They have these things, but if they're only there to solve one problem, and they don't have applications beyond that problem.
Yeah, the nice thing about inflation is that it solved a whole slew of problems and made predictions and everything that could be verified. So we'd have to put this kind of theory to that kind of test and hope that it comes up with explanations beyond just the thing it was made to explain, right?
Yeah, and they're saying there are all sorts of other similar explanations. And whether or not there's things that will, in the long run, do anything really interesting, I don't know. I rather doubt it.
Yeah, we went over the FR theories of gravity, right? Because they're in a similar class.
Well, the FR theories of gravity are, yeah, I mean, they're a class of theories. I'm not sure if they're the same thing. They're a class of changes to general relativity, whereas, you know, this is part of a class of changes to the standard model, basically, that are there to explain even narrower.
Yeah, really just one moment in cosmological history instead of like the whole picture like FR theories are.
Well, yeah. I mean, the FR theories are saying, okay, we don't really know what dark energy is. So what happens if we change the way gravity works? And here's a way to categorize them. And you can look at these different categorizations based on that function, FR. And you can say, okay, that function is linear, that function is inverse square or whatever that you put into your metric, and what happens? And probably basically none of them work, but some of those FR theories end up being other theories that people have put forward for changes to general relativity. These guys, you know, they hypothesize a particle for a very narrow reason, which is we've got this discrepancy between two experiments. I don't know how coherent all of these things are, and I mean coherent in the sense that the different theories that postulate a different energy in order to split the Hubble constant into an early and a late version that we would actually measure differently. I don't know how coherent they are. I don't know if you could put them into sort of one parameter. They have a parameter for this particular thing, right, which is we've got a scalar field, and maybe we put in Lagrangian squared, maybe put in the Lagrangian cubed, and so on. But I don't know if all of those, you can just say, okay, all they really are different powers of this scalar field with different durations or something like that, in which case, you know, you could do some work on that. And you could do the same sort of things that they did with the FR theories, which is, you know, play around with them, find out that this is a this old kind of kinematic relativity sort of thing, and this is this other kind of equation if we put this power in and stuff like that. So they might be able to categorize all these things and say, oh, well, this is actually, you know, an inflaton that showed up after the inflation. Or something like that. Something like that could happen with all of those together. But, I mean, just looking at them, I don't think you really get anything really great out here from this. You know, they end up with H0s around 68 to 70. I don't see anything here that really tells me why there's a difference, and it makes a makes a prediction for someplace else you could look.
Well, I guess the source of the energy itself is kind of a problem. Like, we don't understand how that's working. But on the other hand, we don't really yet understand the source of the energy for the cosmological constant either.
Well, yeah, assuming that it is a cosmological constant, right? So, you know, there are other theories of dark energy as well. Some of them give you something like a cosmological constant, this sort of universal scalar field. Others are different, right? So the cosmological constant is very safe and very vanilla, but it doesn't have any theory behind it.
Yeah, there's no phenomenology, yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't tell us what the cosmological constant is other than it's a number to get the numbers right.
I love the fact that they're doing a really exhaustive survey, the dark energy survey right now, to try to look for any kind of anomalies in the cosmological constant parameter. If they can find any kind of inhomogeneities, then maybe we can start to look at like a mechanistic phenomenological model that'll explain what's really going on. Because like you, I'm not really comfortable just throwing in a number and saying, well, that seems to fix it. Forget about it.
I don't really think anybody is, right? Yeah. And that's part of the reason why there's so many different theories out there. People want to know what it is. But so far, sort of like general relativity has not been modified. It looks like this universal scalar field is the way things end up being. It's just that, you know, we have no idea what it is.
Yeah, the whole idea, I think, of the dark energy surveys, they'll be able to increase the resolution of all those, like, cosmological scale accelerations and see if they can find any kind of anisotropies anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they can find some differences in different places. And if they can, maybe there's something to do there. But, I mean, sort of the whole point of the cosmological constant is it's the acceleration is uniform everywhere. But maybe even with these standard candles and all these other things, they can figure out that it's not.
Yeah, time evolution would be really helpful to find.
Yeah, I mean, it might be that they don't really have that many of these measurements that are in this really tight band with this really tight error. like some of the ones we're talking about today. So they just might not have enough of these different experiments to be able to do that kind of analysis.
Now, there was a study that came up in a few of these papers, actually, a recent Reese study. Adam Reese was the lead of the team, I think, of one of the teams that discovered the dark energy effect in the first place. A lot of the findings are being compared to his results. I think he published something in like 2017 or 2016. 2016, where he found a Hubble parameter of like 73.24, give or take 1.74 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Can you remember? I think it had something to do with the Cepheid variables that he was analyzing.
No, I do not know. 2.4% determination of the local value of the Hubble constant.
Oh, here it is. They used the Cepheid variable star data from the SHOES project in 2016. And the supernova 1A distance scale was calibrated and the Hubble constant estimated. So in this paper, they used optical and near-infrared data.
So that goes into that one category that we talked about, that first category. And yeah, some of these papers use that as part of their analysis. But it's no different than, you know, the ones that we're talking about already. I mean, it's different, but it's not different in concept to some of the other ones we've already talked about. But it's one of the good ones after 2008 or whatever that gives us a really nice separation. 2008 or so, these error bars get pretty low. After about 2010, you really can see the CMB measurements as well, and things sort of narrow down. Looks like there's one sort of astrophysical measurement that is a little bit lower, but all the other ones are high. So CMB measurements from Planck from about 2012 or so, or 2013, are all at one level. WMAP converges towards that. Before 2005, it's just a big mess.
Oh, you're looking at that graph which shows all the different possible parameters from each one of those analyses and then where they overlap.
Yeah, this is from the European Space Agency. And there's also an interesting one at NASA. But yeah, you can look at these and you can just see the time series, and there aren't that many there to look at. So it's good that we have that Reese that looks at one particular spot in the sky, right? And that's basically one distance, right? That would be another interesting thing, is look at all of those different places and look at what happens with those distances, as long as they have a small enough error bar, right? Error bars that are above, let's say, 1 kilometer per second per megaparsec are probably not going to be good enough for this, right? They're just going to be noise, basically, if you want to look at that line.
I think they were saying in that gravitational wave paper that they were only able to look at 4 time delay strong lensing measurements that had been published, but there's like a total of 40 altogether that are going to be available in the future. So they think they'll be able to maybe get their error bars down to a really small percentage.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, actually, that will tell us something. So if those error bars reduce significantly, that's basically going to mean that the distance doesn't matter, right? But if they only reduce a little bit, there's going to be some sort of change in the data from something. And that would tell you whether or not it's worth pursuing trying to line them all up, distance versus Hubble constant, which is already a little bit weird because the Hubble constant already had the distance before, right? So it's like the acceleration of the acceleration, which is a thing.
Is that jerk? Is that what they call that?
Yeah, that's a jerk.
I love that. I always think about House when I...
About House?
You, Lori. Somebody was like, you're kind of an asshole. He's like, I think I'm more of a jerk.
I guess so.
Did you learn anything? There was a great name of one of these collaborations. It was the Holy Cow collaboration. Did you see that?
There was the Holy Cow. There was Shoes.
Astronomers being irreverent.
Yeah, long nights in the observatory.
Yeah, get punchy. Right. That's, I think they were looking at, yeah, so I think that collaboration might have been looking at these gravitational lensing. So I think the Holy Cow collaboration did look at lensing phenomena.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think when I was reading it, I thought maybe it was, I thought maybe this was the same sort of data. Ooh, I didn't notice that.
What?
There's a really bad typo in here for one of the references.
Oh, shit.
Capital Y, capital A with an umlaut, lowercase s with an accent, lowercase lowercase d, capital A with an umlaut, lowercase s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see that, too.
You think that's really the guy's name?
Yesodarser are awesome. Yeah, I don't think so.
So I think these guys are in some way associated with that.
Yeah, because they were also doing the gravitational lensing, so I guess they're comparing the results. The Holy Cow collaboration says that here that it analyzed six multiply imaged quasar systems through strong gravitational lensing and came up with a Hubble parameter of 73.3 plus or minus 1.7.
Okay, so they have the public posteriors of the two different distance scales. So basically what they're looking at are the way they're trying to test modified gravity is they're putting together two different distance scales, one from a time delay from the lensing and one from a more complicated measurement. And so they got some ideas about that from the public information. So I guess they're not associated with that, but they took data out of other people's papers to help them along. So anyways, so we see all these differences. We don't know why there's a difference. And people are giving sort of random answers again about why things are the way they think they are, or why we see these things, see these differences. And that might turn out to be something, or that might just be anytime there's a discrepancy, that's a place for the theorists to jump in and get a paper.
Well, I think one of the things they were saying, it might have been in the first paper, the rock and roll solutions to the Hubble tension. And so in one of these papers, I think it was that one, they were saying that the nature of the disparities that are like persisting within the estimates on the Hubble parameter don't seem to point to systematic errors. Like, it seems like it's increasingly looking more like there might be some new physics there.
And like we were saying, every time they try to improve things, things don't get closer, they get farther away. So that's interesting there. But, you know, you look at different physics, like, well, we were talking about the baryon acoustic oscillations, right? We actually did read a paper about that. That didn't just come out of nowhere. That was the elucidating lambda cold dark matter, the impact of baryon acoustic oscillation measurements on the Hubble constant discrepancy. That one's actually got Bennett in it.
We should probably clarify what the baryon acoustic oscillations are. Those are the large-scale structure of the universe, like the cosmic filaments and voids and all that kind of stuff that resulted from the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background radiation field, which showed like the little bit of density perturbations right before the universe became transparent. They've done like a time evolution study on how the density anisotropies at that surface of last scattering became the structure of the universe as we see it now.
Yeah, so they were talking about, at least in this, they were talking about at that point you have this sort of soup of photons and baryons and leptons, right? And that soup ends up having little basically acoustic waves going through it, and you get little pockets of high density and low density all over the place because they've got what they're calling Compton drag in it, for example. And, you know, you have these interactions via the Compton effect, and they basically slow things down, so you end up with fluctuations just like you would in any damped system. Those freeze out after a particular amount of time, and then you end up with your cosmic microwave background radiation. So you use those models, and you get a better number. I guess part of this is that the dark matter shouldn't be interacting with any of that stuff because it doesn't already, right? So, you know, even if it has some sort of structure, that structure doesn't couple to this other structure. Wherever the dark matter was, it basically stays in whatever state that is, and then it's just our normal matter that makes funny lumps.
Well, they work together, right? Because the dark matter gets attracted to the denser regions of matter, and then the denser regions of matter get magnified gravitationally by the dark matter that gathers around it in the cold dark matter theory, right? So they kind of augment. I think they're saying that you can't have the existing structure of the universe as we see it today with all the concentration of matter without the dark matter that would have accrued around those density fluctuations and amplified the whole consolidation effect.
Okay. I wasn't sure how to do that. It just seemed to me that during that epoch, that drag epoch, you know, you had all that acoustic
noise in the plasma, really, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was all doing one thing, and the dark matter was doing another thing, and you end up with baryon oscillations that are smaller than the dark matter oscillations, because exactly that, the cold dark matter does not participate in the drag epoch.
Yeah, because it's not subjected to acoustic forces, only gravitational forces, right?
Yes, and so, yeah, basically, the cold dark matter peaks have to do with the early universe before the drag epoch, and then the baryon oscillations are during the drag epoch. I'm guessing. That's what I wrote down when I read it last.
Well, I'll trust it.
Okay. So that's what I got down, got there. The weird thing about that was, you know, the way they were modeling things, they were getting, in some cases, you know, the Hubble constant going down to like 53.2.
Whoa.
Kilometers per second per megaparsec. But that has a equation of state for the dark energy with W less than minus one. And W is the ratio of pressure to density, energy to matter in the universe. We've talked about that previously. So they have that equation of state. W equals zero means you just have matter and no energy. And dark energy has W equals minus one. We talked about that a little bit earlier. That's sort of the same sort of parameter. And that's what you'd expect for it to be pure energy pushing things apart. But they have something in that paper where they model it and say, if you add in a particular kind of energy, you end up with a really weird spatial curvature. And they said W was less than minus one, which means something. It means there's a lot of that dark energy, more than before, probably.
Yeah, I think that you end up with a big rip. I think that's what that means.
There was something going on with that somewhere. But one of the conclusions of the paper was making extensions to the cosmic microwave background radiation doesn't fix this Hubble tension.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
Why did we go down to tension? We were at crisis just a couple of months ago.
Well, yeah, I guess nobody wants to feel like they caused any trouble.
Oh, okay.
They don't want to get blamed for a crisis. Come on.
You know, we talked a lot about all these measurements and the different things, and we say, yeah, we've got some people making up fields, but what else are they going to do? This is one of these things. This is one of these things that we're looking at that says there's more physics than the standard model says, and you know, this is one of the reasons why people do particle astrophysics. Or astroparticle physics, or whatever they call it, is to look at things like this, which is actually a reasonably new field. I think the sort of sad thing about this is that we don't really have what looks like a strong candidate for something that would break these two measurements in two. And I don't know if that's because they don't actually understand the measurements well enough, or these two measurements probably shouldn't break in two anyway. Yeah, I mean, it's just strange that we don't have a more concrete picture of what these things are going to do. Although, sometimes when we say concrete picture, we just mean somebody named something, right? Like the axion. What is that really?
That's a hypothetical one, right?
Yeah, it's a hypothetical particle that has something to do with a sombrero.
Yeah, I mean, they hypothesized the inflaton in the same way, right? Like this would solve a problem, but the problem is we've never seen it.
Yeah, we've got inflatons, we have axions. Let me write those down. Maybe someday we should try to figure out what those are supposed to be. We give these things an hour and a half, so...
Yeah, maybe we should start looking at hypothetical particles. I don't know, though, because... I'm just kind of glad that cosmology is giving us really interesting questions to ask and some real mysteries, because I just kind of miss that. Like we haven't been getting that from the particle collider experiments in a long time. So it's nice that, you know, astrophysical observations are giving us a place to ask really interesting questions about theoretical physics.
Well, I guess in a way, the fact that CERN did not find more stuff is more exciting than if they had found some supersymmetric particle. Because now we have no idea what's going on.
You know what answers we don't have. Yeah, I was just doing a quick search here. It turns out the axion was theorized by two of our favorite physicists, theoretical physicists, Frank Wilczek and Steven Weinberg.
Yes, I think we actually talked about that before in one of these things where, yeah, it was the episode with the multiple universe, multiversality. Yeah, and that one, we mentioned that, you know, at some point, Wilczek just kept on talking about axions, and he said, yeah. Yeah, I wonder who invented those. That's really off topic. So I think I've talked about everything that I care to talk about.
Yeah, we're good.
And you're good, so we solved this. We've solved the Hubble.
We haven't solved it. But, you know, that we'll leave it to brighter minds than ours, or at least people that are, holy crap, specializing in pioneering entirely new fields of observation and honing their observational skills to the max. You can see in these papers, you know, how much work it takes in order to tease out the kind of precise data they're looking for. It's pretty rough.
I'm sure they're having a great time. And we can send them your note about, you know, just sort of plotting distance versus H-naught and see if anybody actually ever thought about that.
They had to have, right? They probably got that on their wall. It's like, oh, yeah, let's take a photo.
Yeah, anything you or I think of, they tried, and either they don't have enough information for it or it doesn't actually do anything. You know, some graduate student in his first year got that shot down by his professor when it came. He said, no, that's not going to work. Yeah, that's not going to work. Get back to the lab.
Because it's that much fun to be a grad student. You idiot! What, you didn't think that I would have thought of that? Get back to work. Shut up and calculate. Jim, it's always good talking with you. It was a fun subject. Let's see if we can find something even weirder next time.
Oh, I've got a weird one for you. So
you do, huh? You going to tease us with it? Or
we have to discuss it.
That's good.
Before we actually decide what we want to do next time.
Yeah, we don't want to nix an idea that people are waiting for, yeah.
All right, so thank you very much, Randy. Had a great old time, and I will talk to you again whenever we talk again. I have no idea when that will be.
And thanks to everyone for putting up with us.
Randy, I'm going to cut out all the good stuff.
Oh, shit. All right.
I'll take that stuff, and I'll put it up on the Patreon page.
Are we going to have bloopers? Physics Frontiers bloopers?
Well, yeah, occasionally I do excerpts.
Cool.
I mean, I think we have three levels, right? And basically, when I do any sort of post that's just random, or I do an excerpt or something like that, because, you know, you and I were talking about science fiction novels again or something like that.
Okay.
Horror movies. We probably haven't talked about horror movies in a long time. If I notice them, I'll put that sort of stuff up. Usually I only notice it if it happens in the middle of the conversation, but sometimes I remember, oh, yeah, we did something weird that day. So those things go up for anybody who's a subscriber. For the sort of normal stuff, they get your show notes, and, yeah, that's what they get is your show notes, anything else. And for the 25, it's whatever I think of, which is basically those cartoons. So
now, those are cool, though.
I like them, but they're my cartoons, right?
Yeah.
I mean, other people, they might not care about my cartoons. That's what people get for Patreon, which is, you know, when I find something that I'd like to put up, I put it up. And that goes into $1. We've got something I have to do, which is put your show notes up at $5. And I try to think of something while I'm editing that goes along with what we're talking about and draw a cartoon of it, even though it's not very funny.
We'll take what we can get, Jim.
Yeah, I'm also trying to record at the same time. It's you draw while you're recording.
I can't do that. That's executive function, brother. You can't have two of those going on without going schizo.
Well, thank you. All right, so this went off the rails so long ago.
Yeah, you're going to have to cut it. Just clip out the last half hour.
Yeah, that's why you know there's going to be something in the $1 segment coming up pretty soon.
That's right. It's an investment in our future.
All right. I'll talk to you again soon, okay, Randy?
Sounds good, Jim. Okay. You take good care of yourself.
I will do. Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers episode number 59, The Hubble Crisis. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/59. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as the previous episodes of Physics Frontiers we mentioned in the podcast. I suppose because we did talk about it, I should send you to the Patreon page. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/physicsfrontiers. We are appreciative of any help you can give us. It does cost a little bit of money to run a podcast, but we are very, very happy to have you anyway. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next month. Bye now.